You guys hear about GitHub adding artificial intelligence in so that when you start typing your code, it'll go out and complete your code for you based on previous check-ins at GitHub. Well, I'm happy to announce that they're taking that a step further, and then they're going to create a program for Java developers such that after you die, the computer can keep programming on its own based on your work. Yeah, that's right. The first thing we're going to do is stick your brain in a big jar. Whoa, howdy, ho, guys. It is Friday. It's time for another weekly Nerd Roundup. I am your host, Daniel B. Markham. I have a channel, danielbmarkham.com. I blog there. I sing, I dance, I tell stories. If you've never been to a Nerd Roundup, Nerd Roundup's a pretty simple concept. I take a list of links from the week that I was interested in watching various nerds talk about. Many of these I've talked about myself online. And then once a week over lunch, I sit down with some friends of mine and we kick around the stories and sort of give our take on it. There are a lot of very strict rules for Nerd Roundup. The main rule is there are no rules, which I think we're going to find out big time today. James said he might make it. Greg said he might make it. None of them are here right now, so I'm going to continue. I'm going to sally forth, my friends. Greg will probably show up and drop off a bunch of times because it seems like he was here about 10 minutes ago, then left and came back. I don't know what's going on there. James will come home if he has time. He's out doing chores. So I'm going to kick this thing off, and I imagine during the middle of this we're going to be talking to Greg unless he went away somewhere. Last week, Greg was here an hour early. He's been coming an hour early for various reasons, but he never came back after that. So, heck, I don't know if he'll be back or not. I sure hope he is. All right, so it has been a busy, fun week with the Nerd Roundup stories. This first story is America's plan to build 747 Arsenal ships packed with cruise missiles. Hey, there's just nothing not to like about this. You have a giant 747, a jumbo aircraft. You've got, I think, up to maybe 72 cruise missiles stuck in that rascal. And you just drop it out, and it's like a, I don't know what the hell you'd call it. It'd be a moving missile field, maybe. As you know, the 747 was used to carry the space shuttle around. That's just a workhorse. It is an incredibly robust tool. They never did this. It was called the 747 CMCA, Cruise Missile Carrier Aircraft. But it's still cool, and it kind of brings up something we were talking about last week, and that is, you know, we talk about big IT projects. A lot of times we talk about DoD because the American Defense Department spends a heck of a lot of money on technology. But many, many times technology projects go off the rails. This is a good example of taking stuff you've already got, slapping it together, make you do something it couldn't do before. I think so many times when we're creating weapon systems, we fall back to, you know, what is the coolest, most technical thing we can do to hurt people? Because, of course, we do the idea of what the Defense Department used to be called, the War Department, is to hurt other people. But actually, that's wrong on many fronts. When you engage in a war, the objective of a war is always to make your opponent stop fighting. Now, many times that involves killing a lot of them, but it may not involve killing anybody at all. So a war is concluded when the people you disagree with no longer want to fight you. And so, and also, you can do this through various means. The more, if you concentrate just on delivering kinetic action somewhere, you start concentrating on high technology, and who knows, you might be able to make a bunch of balloons with little smiley faces on them and send them overseas, and people could like us, the war would stop, and we would be good. Insert long discussion here about how war sucks, how I don't support most of the things we're doing right now anyway, but there's a point about IT teams. Many, many times, we get the wrong goal, we solve the wrong problem, we spend a lot of money, we don't even solve that problem right. So 747 cruise missile carrier aircraft, that is just completely cool. Next story, speaking of my libertarian hair on fire stuff, this is a story about how the United States police forces are now mining Google for your location and search history. It begins with a personal story. This guy, Zachary McCoy, who was considered a suspect arrested in a house burglary. He's not a burglar at all, had nothing to do with anything. He just rides his bike in the mornings, and he was riding his bike by a house that was robbed. I don't know what to do. This is a geofence warrant. So we have this principle we've had for a long, long time, which is you see a crime, and then you go figure out who did the crime. And that involves finding the people. Now we're kind of starting with people and then trying to figure out how they were in on the crime. Geofence warrant just says, hey, give me all the people in this two-block radius, you know, for the last year or something. It's extremely, extremely broad. So they're just doing these dragnet search warrants. They bring in all sorts of folks in under the warrant, and then they just throw darts at the wall, make little connections. Biggest problem that police make when they're arresting people, investigating crimes, is focusing in too soon on who it is. And this is a good example of the type of technology that may actually encourage. It's Craig. Craig, you're back, Craig. Can you speak? No, you cannot speak. I heard the bing for you joining, but I did not hear. Hang on, maybe this is it? Nope. Yeah. Got nothing, dude. Once you begin speaking, I will cut your cam on. You could pantomime various answers, I guess. I think you can hear me. Yes.
You hear me now?
I can hear you now, dang it.
Okay, so the entire problem was the headset.
Which you probably decided to use so that you wouldn't have a problem.
Yes, precisely.
Well, we're recording right now. Started off with the first article or two. I told folks that you would probably be coming and going as we got the gear stuff sorted out. So don't tell any dirty jokes like right away. You got to wait to give people a good warning before you start. What you been up to, Greg?
Over the last week, I've actually been doing something really, really fun that people would probably enjoy.
Speak.
So I am moving off to a new place. And as part of moving off to the new place, one of the things that I really wanted to get was a pinball machine. But if you're setting up a room with a pinball machine, then you also have a room for an arcade machine.
Ooh, yeah.
So now you're getting it off into the weeds. So, like, do you buy the original Street Fighter? Or do you buy, like, one of those emulator systems? Or...
Yeah, that's a good one. I don't know. I saw you talking about that on Twitter. Some guy said, this is what I built, and I really enjoyed it. I looked down, like, wow, that looks really cool.
Yeah, and they are really cool. Like, a lot of them, they're basically embedded systems where then they build out a cabinet around it. So instead of having, like, I've got my original Street Fighter, it's, I have 3,000 games in this.
Yes. See, I would not go that route, even though it looks extremely cool and it's very tempting. I'll tell you why. I would want to have sort of the fun of a mechanical pinball machine, a thing that does this one thing.
And No. I'm talking about for video games.
I got you. Same with Street Fighter pinball.
Pinball machine. There's no way in hell I'd ever take an electronic pinball machine. That would just be wrong.
That's not even pinball. It's not pinball.
That's something, but it's not pinball. It's like hitting around pixels.
Yeah. It's not pinball unless you kind of nudge the machine, see how easy it is to nudge. Yeah, fun stuff. I used to love playing pinball. Great, great sport. So have you decided? What was your decision?
Well, I'm going to go with the real pinball machine.
Okay.
And it's a very, very good pinball machine.
Which one is it?
The Addams Family.
Ooh, I played that recently. They have a pinball museum near us, and we went and played for like 4 hours.
Well, so I played this one a lot at an arcade out in Gran Canaria. And what you probably don't know about this is that it was designed by Pat Lawler.
Who's Pat Lawler?
Pat Lawler is a legendary pinball machine.
Oh, okay.
So it's like one of the, and it's considered one of his better pieces of work. So it's one that when I get it, it's going to cost me a significant amount of money to get. But it's also one of those machines that every collector wants.
Okay. It'd be an investment then.
Yes.
I used to love playing the black.
It's one of those that you will buy today and then sell in 20 years for 10 times as much.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that gets me back to the sort of single purpose stuff. I get the build your own console thing. I think as a builder or maker, that sounds like really awesome. But once you start heading down that I want to build a generic game path, Yeah, you end up with a little Raspberry Pi you hold in your hand. It plays all the video games. It's just, it's not really what you're, what I would be looking for, really.
Well, the thing is, the the well-built ones, I mean, they're not that expensive. They come set up with the full casing and everything. They've already had all the games tested on them.
Yeah.
Which, it's going to take you some time to even go through and build up your game collection and test all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. That's true. I think that, to me, I love playing pinball and love playing some of these old video games. But I like the story and the remembering actually walking up to the physical machine and, you know, putting the quarter in and risking your money, bub. Whole quarter.
If you look, a bunch of the emulators today, they actually support taking in quarters.
I would have it no other way. That takes half the fun out. You know, when you put the quarter in, the machine pops when you pop a game. That's an incredible feeling. Cool stuff.
Well, and it's also, it was a big part of the game that you would have to dig in your pocket and pull out quarters.
Yes, or borrow them. Or find a quarter on the floor when you're out of money. God, I found a quarter, damn it!
quick, I can continue.
Yeah, and they had to count down like 10 seconds to continue playing. You had to put the quarter in. Yeah, all fun stuff.
What's hilarious is trying to explain to kids today how that worked. And they just kind of shrug their shoulders like, I have no idea what you're talking about. We go to the machine, we put in a dollar, and then like you play the game and you walk away.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I remember I first saw a 50-cent game. It's like, holy shit, who could ever pay 50 cents? Of course, I was like 17 or 18. And now it's like a buck at a time when you find them. It's crazy. So let's just do this first link. We're about 3 or 4 links in. Did you get a chance to do this? What was this? What is property-based testing?
Oh, boy, this is a good one.
Yes, I figured this would be a good one. It's a shame James couldn't be here, but this is right down his alley. So I read the article, and this guy had built a property-based testing tool. So he's like, you know, I probably should describe what it is. And hell if he actually did it. He did that. Get to the end. I'm like, I'm not really sure. He knows what it's not. And he made an effort for vaguely putting pieces together. And I follow where he's going, but I didn't have a clear definition at the end.
So I have a friend who you might want to bring on to the next episode.
Ooh.
To discuss this a bit more.
Cool.
John Hughes.
That sounds very familiar.
He has done quite a bit of work with property-based testing, including having written Quick Check.
Ah, the guy brings up Quick Check, sure enough, yeah.
Oh, does it? I
yes.
Can't read it. It's too small.
Do what Quick Check does.
It is an amazing piece of work.
So here's what I understood from this. Property-based testing is kind of like fuzzing. As a matter of fact, he said he originally thought it was fuzzing. But now he's saying it's like fuzzing, but you're more aware of what's internal to the app so that when things fail, multiple things fail in such a way that you've predicted they're going to fail.
Yeah.
Okay, I got that right.
And what's always been interesting for me is that as property-based testing was coming up, you also had theorem proving coming up at the same time.
Mm.
Mm. And it was two distinct paths that were kind of competing with each other. Property-based testing, I think, is probably at this point one.
Ah, over theorem proving. Yeah, that's weird. I never really thought of the two as being in competition with one another. But theorem proving just seems like it's such a mathematical thing. Or maybe that's just the people who were left holding that bag or the mathematicians.
Well, they are after the same problem.
Right.
Just in different ways.
Yes. Okay, so just to quickly review theory proving, there's a thing called Curry-Howard isomorphism. And basically what that says in a strongly typed, sort of purely functional way, a computer set of things inside the computer can map almost directly over to hypotheses. And the way the computer code is constructed can map into the way you would prove or disprove a theorem, which is really cool. And they did some really cool, they're still working on some automatic theorem solvers now using the isomorphism. But if I understand you correctly, you were saying that they were trying to take provable code as a sort of in juxtaposition to like this testing with property-based testing?
Well, the two cover the same problem.
Yeah.
In many ways. They were just looking at it from different angles. At this point, I think we can say that the testing side is one.
Yeah, you and I were going to do we talked for a while about doing some more technical stuff, and one of the things that came up was, or maybe it was John and I, were trying to scope out, how do you start? We were thinking about things you do before you program to prevent yourself from making mistakes. And that could be requirements. It could be formal code. There's a whole bunch of stuff that falls into that. But what I find with a lot of these topics is you pull one thing out and there's like 17 other things stuck in there. It's like, holy shit, I didn't want these other 7 days. It's very difficult to scope these conversations. And the reason I said that, you said that these two are very similar. Well, like, yeah, okay, Greg, but nobody wants the thing to crash. So if that's the rubric here, everything is like that. Everything is similar to everything else.
But I would recommend for anyone who's listening to grab QuickCheck and to give it a go. It's been ported to many, many different languages.
There's also F-sharp FS check I have up here. So yeah, I did not have time to dive into this. At first, when I was first scanning the essay, it looked like statistical testing. A lot of people with big data, like insurance companies and such, they have so many records, so much data, that they can actually test the code by just running all the data through.
Yep.
Cool stuff.
That is actually a fairly common strategy.
Yeah, I think at scale, it's a big tool. Why not use this big, cool tool you got?
So one of the things I actually teach in class, and remember, we're talking about these systems dealing with commands and events coming out, right? So one of the things I teach in class is to save all your commands.
Yes, to replay.
Well, you replay off your events normally, but before I do a release, what if I were to replay every command the system has ever done?
Beautiful, beautiful. Yeah, it's cool stuff.
And then I can compare what events came out today versus what events came out last Wednesday. Yes. Are they similar? Or were there some changes that occurred? Are those changes things I expected?
And that's almost a look. Sort of a crossover between traditional programming testing and what we maybe call big data. And it's kind of a spot directly in between both of them where you've got so much data you can't physically process it in your head, but you can certainly run commands or tests on it and then see what doesn't look right.
Well, and if we were to assume that this is going to be running on an in-memory event store with everything mocked out, well, how long is this really going to take to run? I mean, even if we're talking about 100 million commands, everything's in memory. We might be talking about, 24, 48 hours?
Yeah.
It's I reran every single transaction this system has ever done in the past before I pushed it to production.
That's a feeling of surety that's hard to find anywhere else. I mean, you do the same thing. I do the same thing when I'm writing bash code or functional code. I was just thinking about this morning. I've been writing a bunch of scripts this past week. I code it. I code small chunks. I use what I call a code budget. But I code it, and then I keep using it maybe for a period of months. I've got a little chunk of code that does something. I use it for months and months, throw a bunch of commands at it, to your point. And then over time, I become comfortable that it's actually doing what I want to do. And then I go through, and I clean it up, make the parameters okay, and all the other cleanup stuff, but you just can't get around having all that test data. You have to find it somewhere.
So this brings up an interesting thing inside of event source systems. It's very common that I will actually make an event that will discuss an interesting scenario that has happened about another event. For instance, maybe that event that came through was actually involved with a bug.
Yeah.
And those events become very valuable during this process that we're now discussing.
Yes. Yeah, that gets to the, oh, it's not orchestrated.
So today it came across correct, which was different than what it came out before, but then we have the event in the future telling us, no, you actually got it correct.
We were talking about, I can't remember the term, they used to call it orchestration when you were doing the service-oriented architectures. That's where it's not just enough to ask a thing to do a thing, you want to have a nest of things it does, and compare that. That has to be arranged in a certain order and all that.
Yep.
Now, next article is there are 6 internet links on my office on wheels. Did you see this story? No, you got to see this. This guy has this internet connection. It's a thing of nerdy beauty. He works in Australia. He's got a van. He begins by saying, you know, I live a minimalist lifestyle. And he ends with telling us about this 27-node brain surgery machine he's created to get the internet no matter where he is. And it's some really, really cool stuff. I did not know there was an application that would automatically packet switch across various service providers at the same time. And that was a huge win for me. I last looked into this about 15 years ago. To do that kind of work, you're looking at a Cisco router and doing your own code. And now there's an app. Very, very, very cool.
Yep.
Dad, what are you? You're doing phone now? Is that my correct that you're currently streaming to me using your phone?
No, right now I'm actually on hotel Wi-Fi.
Okay.
But here I've got, 3 or 4 backups.
Wow.
Multiple phones. I have portable router. I have.
I thought you froze for a minute. It's like, I have a. No, come back, Greg. My internet is awesome. I need to do more on my side of stuff. I at one point I had a fiber optic, I had a T1 lease, and now I got like Pringles cans, basically.
What I really miss is when I was living in Vancouver, because I was living in the core.
Ooh.
So I was living in a skyscraper. The internet that we had was just Cat5 cable.
Yes. Yeah. Last time I worked in
Silicon Valley. It was the best internet I think I've ever had.
I know. Last time I worked in Silicon Valley, I'm like, they just give me, it's a 100 gig cord. Just plug the cord in and bam, whatever you want. It's there already. Yeah. It's amazing.
I'm not sure what the building had run to it. I know it was fiber.
Yeah.
And that's... I never worried about a thing with it.
It's like the memory thing. You start with not a lot, and you get some more and more. And the more you have, the more you really want to have. And the more it's like, well, I can do like holograms now. It's cool stuff.
Well, keep in mind, this is 10 years ago. The internet that I had there was good enough to live stream movies.
Wow, 10 years ago.
Yeah. Actually, a bit more than 10 years ago, but that's how good the internet was.
Yeah, it's amazing. I have a checklist of stuff I go through for this podcast. It's I take the Wi-Fi down, I go hardwire into the router, bunch of stuff. And even then, we've had some problems here or there. It's just so many pieces when you have a low bandwidth, and all those pieces have to work exactly the right way to make it work. So the next article is Science is Not Just Philosophy. And I love this because this is a good example of an argument where the guy is wrong but does not understand why he's wrong. And so he makes a wonderful, eloquent argument. If you want to collapse this to politics, people who are anti-vax or questioning science, these people are wrong. This is basically his essay. And it gets into a whole bunch of butthurt that science has had with people over the years, evolutionists, the anti-vax folks. It all comes down to the thing of science being tentative and argumentative and always evolving. And people looking at that and saying, well, you just don't know anything, do you? It's like, well, no, we know a lot of stuff.
Let me rephrase that slightly. So in philosophy, I can come up and make a statement which is determined to be true. In science, that does not exist.
No.
There is no true statement.
No, there's no true statement. And the thing here is that, yes, there's a field of study called epistemology. Epistemology is all about how we know things we know. And I think it's probably one of the most important courses I've taken. I would not take it until I was 30, however, because it'll just totally fuck up your idea of like what you know, what you don't know. We don't know a whole bunch of stuff. Shit still works. We can do some really, really cool stuff like build atom bombs, even though we don't really know for sure a lot of stuff.
Well, but a big part of science also assumes that things can change.
Yes.
What is true today may not necessarily be true tomorrow.
Which was one of the huge things about general relativity was the idea that speed of light was constant was really mind-blowing because it doesn't make empirical sense with any other thing, any other kind of speed concept we have, pretty much. So this guy does a wonderful argument. I don't disagree with the internal coherence of what he's saying, but I think there's a swishing sound where he completely missed the point of what was happening. And it's sad. Smart guy. But I love reading essays that I find eloquent but wrong because it tells me a lot about how people misunderstand one another.
Yeah.
Have you heard of polygenic baby screening?
This is one that I was not highly familiar with.
I had never heard of it until Paul Graham tweeted about it the other days. So polygenic baby screening, we came up with in vitro fertilization where we could create babies in the glass and implant them in the mother's womb. And almost right away, people started saying, well, I really don't want to have a child if he's going to have not such a good chance to live. And the doctor said, hey, we can screen for a couple common things. Well, over time, that list of stuff we can screen for has gotten larger and larger.
Right.
And so it went from...
And it's going to continue to get larger.
It will.
I mean, eventually we're going to reach a point of, well, I don't really want a baby if they're not going to be 6'4".
That's where we're headed. And we're much farther toward that than I ever thought that we were. So Paul's point when he tweeted the other day was, this will be a big step in evolution because... We are now at the point, I just want a blue-eyed kid that's going to be 6 foot tall. You know, you can start doing this very realistically. It's not pie in the sky stuff anymore. So that's just, I don't know about it. That's weird.
What the really weird part about it is, in terms of evolution, is that it's no longer going to be the environment selecting.
Yes, you got it right. We did this thing where sex is kind of mostly sort of random for our purposes of our discussion. And down the road, nature, the environment, chooses which genes to propagate or not. You rinse and repeat that 1,000 times, you have evolution. But now we're going, no, ahead of time, I know what I want the kid to be like. It's like, maybe that's going to help you in evolution sense, maybe not.
Well, and there are some circumstances where it would actually be beneficial. And there's some circumstances where it would not be beneficial. Yes.
It gets down to the randomness of the future environment. If you understand correctly exactly what the future environment is going to be, sure, you could maybe make some reasonable guesses. I want the kid to be tall because taller people are more attractive, and a list of stuff like that.
No. It's that you're reaching a different form of selection.
Right.
So if you really get into evolution... evolution, you can also call sexual selection.
Correct.
So, evolution optimizes for things that want to be mated with.
Yes.
Now, the criteria of what wants to be mated with does not necessarily match the criteria of where things should actually go. I mean, otherwise, nerds would be a lot more popular.
That's just where I was going. Nerds can have sex now, too. Woohoo! it's the sexual selection thing is interesting.
I read a study some time ago. You are actually less likely to have children if your IQ is over 140.
That's exactly correct. And if both your parents have high IQs, it's even less likely that you have kids. Yeah. They're more likely to be professionals. They're more likely to worry about things other people wouldn't worry about. The beginning of the movie Idiocracy, them boys ain't lying. That's a real thing. You should check that out. You see that, Idiocracy?
Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite movies.
Wow, spot on. Next year, I saw this tweet come by Saturday or Sunday. This guy's working on a fluid solver, which uses physics to predict what fluid does. I don't know if this video will play or not. He's got 3 million particles in real time at 40 frames per second. Yep. I'm like, holy shit, that is amazing. That's just think about the computational issues of that. That's just wow. See if I can bring this up here. And you look at it, and of course, water like hair is one of those things that they struggle with for a while to get right. But this is wild. There we go. So I am in awe.
What's more funny is that in 5 years, it's going to be standard in every 3D engine for video games.
Yes, it'll be in your phone in 5 years. Sure, your phone will be 170 degrees, but it'll be your phone. yeah, cool stuff. What is this next one? This is just a follow-up for the guys who are still interested in polygenic testing. This is a recap of how much progress we've made. I think this one guy, when he started 20 years ago, they had a budget of $6 billion to do one genome, and now you can get your genome done with like $3,000
or $4,000. Yeah. Well, and that's going to continue driving down in price. That's been following essentially Moore's law, and
well, you know, it gets me is that we see all this stuff in tech that starts off as being kind of rare, that only hackers can do it, and then it becomes such that we're able to do it, but only organizations do it, the government or these genetic people, whatever. And then we reach this other stage, it's where anybody can do it. So I can see it's very easy reaching a point where you could determine who was in your house while you were gone. It's just weird stuff.
Well, and with DNA in particular, as the cost continues to drop, there's going to be some really, really interesting stuff that starts coming up in, say, 100 years.
Yes. And one of the things, we try to come up with terms that sort of make it more relatable. You know, the Star Trek tricorder is one of the terms I hear people use. They're able to take lasers right now and look around corners. And the way they do that is you shine a laser on the wall, and the computer reverse models the wall's reflection to determine what the wall's reflecting off of. Yep. So seeing around corners, seeing who's been here, what kind of creatures are in the area. I mean, all this stuff, it was total bullshit just 30 years ago. And now it's all kind of coming together where it might actually happen. Next article is, as a solo developer, I decided to offer phone support, and this is what happened. If you want to just read the whole thing, is good things happened. To answer the question. I love reading stories like this as well, because get out and talk to the fucking people you're trying to help. Oh my God. Answer the phone. Because I tell you something, if you're trying to make something that's useful for folks and you feel like you don't want to be interrupted by somebody calling, how the hell do you think your users feel when they got to pick the phone up and call you to tell you something doesn't work?
Well, this is something I've told young developers for many, many years. That in order to really understand their project, they need to go work support on their project. And this isn't necessarily just frontline support. It could also be support for the admins running the back end. Yes. It could also be support for database administrators. It could also be support for... You need to actually see the issues that are really happening. Where people, even if they're not real issues, it's just where people are getting confused.
Yes, yes. I think what you consider an issue and what they consider an issue are completely different things. You know, Greg, you and I have been doing this for more than a year or two. We've been making code, teaching, watching teams. I don't think I have ever, ever seen a project that had too much user engagement, ever. However, most of the failure projects I've ever seen had zero to little user engagement, sometimes using a BA, sometimes no user at all. But I don't think I've ever been in a spot. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Yeah, it's funny because we have this whole like family of people, BA, project manager. They're still there, but we tell them they don't have roles. It's like, well, what do I do? Well, you're a developer. Well, I don't know how to develop. Yeah. So I don't know what we're going to keep calling those guys. I don't know.
So one thing I like to do, and a lot of people don't do this, is I like to log every error that happens in production.
Yes, I've seen that as well. Yes.
To see where people are running into problems.
If you can't meet a user, that's probably the second best thing to do, is just go through your logs and start digging down to see what's happening that they didn't expect to happen.
Well, and you can't do it for all things, obviously. It's like sometimes I expected them to go here, and then they didn't go there.
Right.
But at least with errors, I can log every single error that is actually occurring, and I can go through a minimization strategy on those errors.
Yes.
Even if it's stupid crap in the UI, like, we asked you to put a date, but you put 08, and we expected you to put 8.
It's weird. You're talking about mining it to reduce the amount of churn in your user base. You know, we see businesses that have these solutions that maybe work for 99% of the time. The other 1%, frankly, it's not cost-effective to chase after. But when you do that, when you write a feature, everyone does a 1%. So multiply it by a million people. You know, you're having quite an economic impact as a coder simply by not making sure your program never crashes.
Right.
Yeah, it's...
There's another one here which isn't really focused on enough, and you see it in system after system after system, which is that UI interactions are not standardized across the UI.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow. Yeah.
So the way you input a date time here is different than the way you input a date time there.
When I was working with startup folks, a lot of times we talk about landing pages and the funnel and a lot of different ways about how your tech interacts with people the first time. And you really don't want to interact with people. And by that, I mean you want to help people with zero interaction if possible, right? You want, hey, I need to know how to do blah. I push a button and it tells me how I speak and it tells me how to do blah. That's the goal. Not to take whatever data structure you think might have and stick it into some sort of homemade, you know, JavaScript box or whatever. That's the opposite of the goal.
Ah, but doing the thing that is effective is a lot less fun than doing the one that's ineffective.
Well, and you know that it's really cool because when you start thinking of it in that reverse way of what's the minimal amount of stuff, you start thinking, well, you know, actually I could have people use my app for some time without even knowing their email address. And so you'll see really good apps that'll progressively ask you a tiny bit of information at a time as you continue to engage with the product. And that feels very friendly and easy to use. You get to know, you're getting to know your app. It's kind of a human thing. But then the bad ones are like, fill out this 40 box form and hit submit. And if you get one thing wrong, we'll just say wrong. We won't tell you what's wrong or anything. Just get good luck, guys.
Well, the really good ones, when you're on a mobile phone.
Oh, my God.
They're just going to ask you to associate one thing, and then they've got all the back-end code to take that one thing and associate it to 47 other things.
That you couldn't display on there if you wanted to.
We're going to do it automatically, because that's actually our business model.
I think a lot of this could be fixed, like you said. Get on the help desk, look at your error logs. So this is fairly simple stuff, but we don't really teach people to make programs for other people anymore. We teach them to make programs, which is different.
What I found funny is I have worked with many teams as a consultant where when I ask the question of what is the last user issue that you dealt with where you talk to the user? Never.
But you know, the business isn't happy with how... Yeah, I guess they probably aren't happy with how things are going.
They've never had their developers sit and talk to an actual user. I can tell you, back when I was working with horse racing, this was one of the biggest things that we did. We would go and sit with the tellers who used our machines. And we'd ask them, what sucks?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is one of my favorite stories. Apologies if you heard it before, but I was reading this article by Agile Tech Coach who went to work in the real world cutting code for a brokerage firm. And as part of that work, they sat his ass down beside a broker, and he worked alongside the guy for a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And at one point, he said, you know, I was working alongside the guy, and that guy said, you know, it'd be really good if we had a button over here that did blah, 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 because it's just time intensive to have to do this. So he went and made a button. And the business is like, this is the most productivity-enhancing thing we've ever had from you guys. And it's like a two-second thing he did that actually saved them a bunch of money. The business is very happy. It's the amount of work and complexity we put in as coders does not relate at all to the kind of value somebody's getting out the other side of this thing.
I've run into this with traders as well, where it's... We all decide to go out one night after work. And we've been sitting around having some beer. And the discussion comes into, like, what can we do to improve this? And the tendency tends to be is, you know, you're showing us too much information here.
Yes. Yes.
Could you offer to filter our information based on the following criteria? Yeah, that'll take me like 25 minutes, maybe.
Yeah, that's just awesome. Nobody else could do this for us.
The following morning, it's out. Like, oftentimes, it's even the laptop gets pulled out in the pub. Hold on, let me add that really quick. Okay, I've done it. It should be there at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
But, you know, the thing is, you didn't hear the beginning of this. I was talking about one of the mistakes police investigators make many times is they lock in on a suspect too soon. They think, oh, it's supposed to have been Joe. And so then they're subconsciously just thinking, like, Joe is the guy. Well, you do this coding. This past week, James and I want to do some transcripts for these roundups, right, to put them online. I found a service called Otter.ai. They have 1,200 free hours of transcripts a month. Like, way cool. I uploaded an hour-long nerd roundup. They said, nope, we only take this in 40-minute or less chunks. So I'm like, fine, I'm a programmer, I can solve this. And so I went through and, I did this 100-line bash monstrosity that would go through, here's up on the screen here, would go through and figure out how long the thing was, how, you know, what were the silence, pieces of silence was, each of these had parameters. It was 100 lines of code before it was all over. And what I initially did was I found the top N number of silent parts in the video and split there. Well, it turns out you can't do that because we were silent at the end a lot. At the beginning, we weren't. So then I went in a second time. And this time I did like 50 lines of code, and turns out that wasn't it either. So I wake up Sunday morning. I'm like, you know, really, there's just one line of code I need. So it's one line of code with two parameters. Boom, I'm done. But my point being, had I been a programmer listening to my problem, I'd still be working on 100 lines. Matter of fact, it might be 200 lines now. I keep making it more and more complicated. We focus in on what we're doing, naturally assuming that must have value when it never, hardly ever does. The value comes from somewhere else, in our case.
Yeah.
this is a cool, if you're like hacking stuff, this guy hacks Casio watches, which I thought was, I had no idea that it was even a thing. These watches are about $18 a pop, and you can do all kinds of really cool stuff. He puts a cellophane backdrop, solar panel, an SD drive. It's amazing.
I don't think you have the image up.
Yeah.
That's a Casio watch.
I'm sorry. There we go. And so there's a video here you might want to link to. It's just a ton of different hacks. The SD drive was blew my mind. It's like, wow, a watch with an SD drive. I can handle that.
Why not? There are actually some very similar to Casio watches where they've added hardware to them. So one of the more fun ones is to do radio band emission detections.
Ooh.
Think about as you're walking around.
War driving with your watch, right?
Or let's imagine... I had one not so long ago, an ex-girlfriend who thought there were bugs in the house, like wiretappings.
Oh, boy.
So with my watch, I could walk around and, are we seeing any emissions here?
I was just picturing this conversation occurring. Well, you know, I think there may be bugs in the house. Never fear, I have my watch. I was like... Yeah, bad time to have, like, the maid or somebody come in, like, what are your guys? I'm checking for bugs with my watch here. It'd be fine. You're speaking to the watch here.
This would be a really, really fun one to try to explain when the police came over.
That's what I'm saying. It would not make any sense to anybody what you're doing, but except for me, I understand exactly what it is. And it's such an odd thing as well. Like, somebody asks you a tech question, you're like, hey, I got my watch here.
The main usage for the watch in question is actually dealing with Wi-Fi networks.
Yeah, war driving, where you're walking around looking to see if you can pick up Wi-Fi. Yeah, that's cool.
No. It's not if I can pick it up. It's are there alternative signals? So basically what I'm doing is I'm looking, are there other signals that are happening around me that could possibly be screwing up with my Wi-Fi?
Okay.
And yeah. It's not just Wi-Fi. It can also be 3G. It can also be... Basically, it's just telling you on the spectrum what things it's seeing.
I actually thought about getting an EMF reader last month or two. Just, they look just so fun. It looks like a fun little toy. So here I have my Casio watch. I never got it. My wife has a smartwatch. My daughter has one. Have you ever bought a smartwatch, Greg? I just never clicked with me. It looked like a
bunch of... Hold on. I gotta walk over here because you are going to have a good laugh at this.
Oh, no.
This is my watch.
Nice watch, dude. What is that?
Wait.
Oh, yeah, the one with the clear back. Yeah, I saw that. That's a beautiful piece of gear.
Well, it was also all of like $150 or something.
Yeah, I'm okay with all sorts of high-tech, you know, the ear implant or whatever, but the watch thing just looked pretentious. And if I want to be pretentious with my watch, I'll buy a Rolex or something. I don't think it's very snooty looking to be speaking to your hand. It doesn't do a lot to me.
When it comes to watches, there is no way in hell I will ever put on any technical watch. If the technology is past maybe 1900, I don't think I'm interested in
it. Yeah, it's a thing of beauty. You don't need a watch to tell you the time. We've got plenty of ways to tell the time. You need a watch because it's fun. You enjoy looking at it. It's an attractive piece of art.
Well, and then you've got the gears that have been built into it. And you can look at the mechanism and how the mechanism actually works.
Yes, yes. And that's high-tech stuff going back hundreds of years. That's both really cool, nerdy, and like history, both.
Exactly. And it's also something you can spend days of research getting into and understanding.
Yes. Okay, so we've got a couple more to go over. This one I'll skip through kind of quickly. U.S. Intel operatives admit hacking American networks with United Arab Emirates. So these guys used to work for U.S. intelligence. They were hired by UAE to do terrorist checking, and they ended up hacking into America's computers and taking our stuff. So the lesson here, and Greg has gone away, I guess he's coming back. The lesson is that people want these back doors. They want all this.
Oh, I got back into you.
You are back. Yes. I see the little G. There you are. Hey. So this is the UAE story. We build shit. We want to have back doors in it and all this crap because we're afraid of criminals or think of the children or whatever. When you build the stuff that's buggy, you pay people how to break into it. And guess it's our own guys breaking their own stuff being paid by somebody else. You can't have an insecure crypto system, no matter what the cause is, no matter how good the cause, and not have that come back and bite you in the ass at some point.
Well, it's kind of like having a lock on a door that you know has a second key to it. And then you are just going to assume that second key never gets used for any nefarious purpose.
It is insane. It's insane. And one of the first things they teach you if you learn about security is that it's not necessarily the tech, it's the people. You want to hack somebody's password, you put a gun to their head and tell them, give me your password. So you can't build any back doors into anything where some magic person has all the keys to all the locks. That's just never, ever going to be a good idea. It's beyond stupid. And I think, Greg, what we're in here, we're basically been in a cyber war for about 20 years now. It's escalated. There's no rules. Everybody's playing as hard as they can. And it's just under the radar of most people, I guess. People do not realize what kind of crap is going on out there.
Well, a big part of it is that people inherently trust technology.
Yes.
Without realizing that, well, there's a lot of things that can be done that, well, are nefarious.
Yeah. I did a story, it was a month or two ago, about a guy who had a bunch of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. And they just, criminals just kidnapped him and said, okay, give us your password. And then he gave him the password, took all his money out, and they walked away billions of dollars, just like that.
Yeah. And it's completely untraceable.
Yeah. And so, either you understand that this is the world we live in and you don't support backdoors and you don't support all the spying, or you don't understand this is the world we live in, and you think there's going to be some magic person to come save you when there's a problem. It's like, that person does not exist in reality. Next one is this good article I'm also not diving down on. This is the physics anomaly nobody talks about, what's up with neutrinos. This lady, who's done some really good stuff in the past, makes the case that there is a six sigma measurement difference in neutrinos that means something the fuck's going on, we don't know what, but for whatever reason, nobody talks about it. Maybe they don't like neutrinos, I don't know. Sad. Somebody should speak for the neutrinos, Craig.
Well, the thing is, and I'm going to take a wild guess on this, is that going down that path is likely going to change quite a few things that they think they've already understood.
Yeah, where I think we are now, as a layman, is that we're seeing a lot of really small variations in real data from where they should be. Nothing huge, but just a lot of little nibbles around the edges, such that most reasonable physicists, I believe, knock on wood, most reasonable physicists think, yeah, something's going to have to be rejiggered. And when we jigger it, it's going to be, everything's not going to be the way it used to be.
Well, and it's going to roll out.
And this gets back to that science is not philosophy, I say. You know, it's not that we don't know anything. It's that there's multiple ways to map the things we do know onto various mathematical structures.
Well, and the big problem you're going to run into, being the person who says this is what it is that pretty much everyone's going to be like, we don't want to remake all of our models. You must be wrong.
What was the old phrase? That science grows one obituary at a time.
You need to come forward with a level of proof that is incontrovertible.
You know, it's proof and it's reproducible experiments. You know, what we ran into with string theory was, guess what? We can make a mathematical construct so complicated that varies so much, it can both be true and pointless at the same time because there's just too many levers to pull to make it. Want to work like this? I'll pull these levers.
Right.
Yeah, so it's just because you can map it to math doesn't mean it's anything. I had to talk about this. Last week we talked about nuclear electric spacecraft. I wanted to differentiate between the two current kinds because it's important. One is the ion drive stuff, which is way cool. We have spaceships in orbit right now that are using that. The second one, nuclear thermal. This is you run something by a really, really hot radiation pile. We're talking about getting to Mars in a month or less.
Well, there's a third one as well. The third one is the large initial propulsion, essentially setting off a nuclear weapon behind the ship.
Oh, yeah, yeah, the Orion stuff. Yeah, sure. Inerva.
Which, it moves you very quickly, very fast. But it might destroy your ship in the process.
And it would be easy to see where the ship was, because it's going to be bright.
Right.
Yeah, the Air Force actually had studied nuking the moon in the 1960s and decided against it because they felt like, for some reason, people might not like us nuking the moon.
Well, at least if we watch movies, we should all be glad that there's not Nazi bases on the moon.
Oh, my God. If you guys have not watched Iron Sky, it is a wonderful B-movie about Nazis on the moon. I'm reading this book. I'm listening to an audiobook right now that I saw Bob talk about the other day. It's about, well, it's basically Moon is a Harsh Mistress, just kind of redone. It's about a lunar colony that begins to revolt against the Earthlings who keep telling them what to do. And it's a good book. I'm really enjoying it. So check this out. We know that these UAVs are getting smaller and smaller. They made a dang UAV that's the size of a piece of sand. That just blows my mind. That is incredible.
What you really need to worry about, it is not the one that's the size of a piece of sand. You need to worry about the 200,000 of them that are the size of mosquitoes.
Yes. Yeah, so this is where we're headed. We're headed for swarm systems that you can't see very well with the naked eye. And when we reach that point, you don't really know. I would make the argument that a human being really isn't aware of what their surroundings are at all anymore. If you're at the point you can deploy stuff like that.
Yeah.
Cray, cray. Is that it? What else we got? I think there's one more maybe. Oh, yeah. Okay, so there's this phone you could buy. And it was like, what was it, $1,200 a month for the phone? It's like a $2,000 phone and $1,200 a month, and it doesn't run half the stuff you want to run. But, hey, it guarantees you a secure message with whoever you're talking to. So all these guys bought them. Tens of thousands of people bought these phones worldwide. And it was actually a phone developed by the Federal Bureau of Investigation in the United States. And so the funny thing with Hacker News is like, wow, that's a lot of monthly recurring revenue for a phone. It's like we're instantly analyzing the business model here. So yeah, don't buy phones from the FBI, guys. This would be the tip of the week.
Probably not the best idea.
Every message went directly to FBI headquarters.
Well, wait. We have to be more clear here. It depends which country you're in and what you're messaging about. They might be quite happy about all the things that you're doing that would be otherwise looked down upon.
Yeah, that's weird, because the same data stream you're creating every day could be a crime in one spot, could be praised in somewhere else. I don't know about that. I can't imagine they made 800 arrests around the world. I'm still trying to process this whole idea of the FBI building
phones.
You
have to understand. This is a very, very common thing for police to be doing. I think I mentioned before, I used to work as a DJ. Mm-hmm. So when you would come to the raves, often the drug dealers were police.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Uncomfortable truth number 17, yeah.
But they're not trying to arrest the person that's buying the drugs. That they're not interested in them. They're interested in people that are higher up.
In a totalitarian state, the criminals are all law enforcement. So the more you want to grasp onto people and get them to do what you want to do, that you're just creating this class of criminal that's even more difficult to try to figure out where they are and sort through.
But what they were really doing, and it makes total sense when you think about it. So let's say at this nightclub, they've set up their guy as the local drug dealer.
Okay.
Or one of the better well-known ones. Now, he's become part of the network. He's a low-level player in the network, but he's part of the network.
Right. Trusted.
So now, who's the guy above him? Who's the guy above them? Who's the guy above them?
Yeah, I just don't want to get... I don't want to do my hair on fire thing, but this is a game we've been playing with Rico and with the drug stuff for some time. You find a little guy, you charge him, tell him he's going to jail for 20 years unless he rats out the guy who hired him. And what that ends up doing is making these networks very, very strict as far as their security rules. If you ever watch The Wire, you know, the guy who pays for the drug never gets the drug from that guy. He gets it from somebody else. So you're never actually paying and getting it at the same time.
Right.
Just the more you overcomplicate the plumbing, the easier it is to stop up the sink, I think Scotty said on Star Trek one. All right, so let me do my goodbye thing. Here, let's see. Hey there. You have wasted yet another hour with the Nerds of the Nerd Roundup this week. We're happy to have you. We're glad you did not take this time to help orphans or do anything else that may make you a better person. Instead, you come by and hung out with us. I'm Daniel Markham. I will see you on the internet.